6 o'clock. Welcome. I'll turn the microphone over to Mr. Manager.
Well, thank you for coming. At long last, we are prepared to present some ideas about, as you can see, creating a municipal utility community solar program. Staff's been working on this for quite a while, and I know that there's deep interest at the council level about this, so we're very excited to bring this to you today with some very important partners that I'll have Ted introduce here in a moment. So we want to devote the whole hour to this topic and leave as much time as we can for Q&A. And with that, Ted?
Well, thanks for the opportunity to discuss community solar with you this evening. Jenny Heater is here to discuss a concept that is gathering a great deal of attention nationally, known as community solar. Jenny is with the National Renewable Energy Laboratories and is a staff liaison for the Department of Energy's Solar Technical Assistance Team working on the SunShot initiative. The National Renewable Energy Laboratory is participating in SunShot by offering their expertise and technical assistance to state and local governments. This is non-financial assistance, offering technical support where needed by state or local governments. Water and Light has applied for this technical assistance last February, and we feel community solar is appealing from a number of different perspectives and started working with the National Renewable Energy Laboratories in July. NREL gave this presentation as a webinar to the Water and Light Advisory Board at their October meeting. So with that for an introduction, I would like to welcome Jenny Heater to come up for the community solar presentation. Thanks.
Thank you for that introduction, and thank you for having me here today. It's great to be here in person, and I'm going to run through about 20 minutes of material and then hope to have some good question and answer session time after that. So just as a little bit of background, so you all know, the National Renewable Energy Lab, NREL, is funded by the Department of Energy, and as part of some work that we're doing for the Department of Energy, we're helping state and local governments, including municipal utilities, look at community solar and other types of solar projects that they can implement in their service territories. So I'm just going to provide an overview of community solar, looking at some of the key issues around the country, some key considerations for local governments or others who may be implementing a community solar program. So just for a little bit of background, so we're all on the same page in terms of what is community solar. Community solar basically allows customers, and by customers we mean any type of rate class, to participate in a solar project that's not located on their property, but at the same time receive some of the project's power and or financial benefits. So how we see this commonly is that there will be a large solar array located on either city or other property, and a number of customers will get a share of that project. For some national context, there are about 38 community solar programs around the country, and we do have a list of those programs that I've left with staff if you're interested in seeing that, as well as a copy of this presentation. About 14 of those are municipal community solar projects, which is about 40%. And also, just for some national perspective, in a few states there is legislation that mandates a community solar program. That's happened in Colorado, where NREL is located, most recently in California, and also Washington, D.C. So in some cases, these programs are operated as part of a renewable portfolio standard or something like that. But in the majority of states, it's up to the utility to choose to offer that type of program. This is information you guys should be well aware of, but one of the first considerations, you know, in deciding to operate a community solar program is whether there's interest in solar in the area. So you all probably know there's a couple different markets for solar going on right now in your area, whether that's net metering solar, the Solar One project, or solar that's being used to meet RPS. In terms of motivations for offering a community solar program, from the programs that have developed already, we see a variety of motivations and benefits to different sectors. So from the ratepayer perspective, this really allows ratepayers who can't put solar on their home because it's shaded, because they're renters, because they live in a condo, it allows them to participate in solar. So that's a big advantage from the ratepayer perspective. It can also offer solar at a price that might be competitive or even lower than if they had put solar on their house. So some of that is just because of economies of scale, and that, you know, if you're developing a project that's 10 times larger, you'll get a better price point. And then thirdly, we talk about customer engagement a lot in terms of municipal utilities being interested in engaging their customers and providing them options and making sure that they're really responding to customer needs. So that's another benefit that programs have seen on the ratepayer side. In terms of economic focus, a lot of programs have seen a local solar industry being supported, whether that's through their installers or other folks marketing programs and things like that. You can also support larger, potentially lower cost, as I mentioned, solar projects. And then from the utility perspective, we see a variety of benefits. Most utilities are using the community solar to fulfill their RPS requirements. That's their renewable portfolio standard requirements to get a certain percentage of renewables by a certain year, that kind of thing. Some utilities are just interested in increasing diversity of their generation portfolio, so they want to transition and include more solar as they go along. Other utilities want to maximize the use of an existing resource, so they may have a plot of land that has been identified as a great solar resource for a variety of reasons, and they want to make sure that that resource is utilized. So what do you need to think about in terms of how to do a community solar program? We know that there are a lot of programs out there. This model has been tried in many different ways. What are some of the key considerations? One of the first considerations is the type of ownership structure. So we present three models here, really two models and a hybrid model, which I'll talk about a little bit more detail in the next slide. But the primary options are either the utility owning the system, a third party owning the system, or a flip structure, where a third party may own the system and then turn it over to the utility at some point. So I want to talk about some of the benefits and considerations for each of those models. With the utility-owned model, you guys are a municipal utility, so in that sense, there's a great community connection. Some of the key considerations, though, are on the financing side. So at the federal level, we have the investment tax credit, which provides a 30% tax credit for investment in solar projects. That's clearly not something that a municipal could take advantage of. On the other hand, there may be qualified energy conservation bonds that may be available to finance part or some of that project. Another key consideration for the utility-owned model is there will be just increased operational and maintenance responsibilities, and that's something to consider, you know, if that's something you want to take on or not. And programs can be structured in different ways to accommodate your interest in terms of whether you want to operate and maintain a system. From the third-party owner perspective, so third parties owning systems are pretty likely to be able to take advantage of the investment tax credit, so you see a financial benefit in that sense. The utility won't be able to claim the solar project as an asset if the third party is owning that system. And in some cases, third parties may provide additional administrative services. So that can be things like billing, customer billing. They may take care of some of that instead of having the utility do it all themselves. So those are the two primary models. And then what we want to look at is a flip structure where you see some benefits of both of those models. And actually, I'm going to flip to the next slide because it has a little bit more detail. But how the flip structure works is really started off as a way to help with some of the tax credit issues. So if a third party is owning the system, that party can take advantage of the investment tax credit as well as some accelerated depreciation benefits. And typically that third party will own the project for about 6 years in order to take advantage of those benefits. And at that point, the ownership can flip back to the utility or the project developer. So it's a way to sort of have some of both. You can take advantage of some of the financial components, but also end up retaining ownership in the end. And these agreements can be structured in a variety of ways. A number of them have upfront buyout points. So it could be structured that after, you know, 6, 10, or 15 years, the utility will have the option to buy out ownership. Some flips are also structured that once the investor has made a certain return, it'll flip back to the utility. So there are a number of ways that that can be done. But it is important to know that the power purchase agreement price that the utility is paying, that could be held constant, and it's just dependent on how that agreement is structured up front. So that's sort of the lay of the land in terms of project ownership. Another key consideration is how do you design the program for your customers? So your customers don't necessarily care, you know, if there's a flip structure or, you know, utility owned or any of that. But what they want to know is how do I participate? So we see two different models here, either capacity-based or generation-based. And what we mean by capacity-based is that the customer is buying a kilowatt instead of a kilowatt hour. Kilowatt hour would be a generation-based model. So with the capacity-based, you may have somebody buying, for example, 3 kilowatts of this community solar garden or community solar project, similar to, you know, if they're putting 3 kilowatts on their home. With that, there are a few considerations in terms of how does that translate into my bill. So I've outlined a couple of ways that that's commonly done here. So when we're crediting folks on their bill for that generation, you can look at the actual generation of that system. You can look at an estimated generation if you don't have metering data for that particular month. Or you can credit folks based on the estimated total life generation, which will take into account the fact that systems will degrade over time. So that's another component to look at. The key consideration with the generation-based model is that if you're guaranteeing folks can purchase a number of kilowatt hours, you have to make sure those are generated, right? So how do you do that? The way that we've seen it be done, and Sacramento does this, is they only sell about 95% of what they expect the output to be, so they have a 5% buffer. So if, you know, for whatever reason output isn't what they thought it would be for a particular month, they have that buffer that they can use. So they're making sure that they meet customer demand. And I did want to just provide a couple examples of these different models. So for the capacity-based model, there's the Wright Hennepin Cooperative. It's up in Minnesota. Members there purchase their panels for $869, which actually includes a storage component, which is a little bit unique. But then the members receive monthly bill credits for the power that's produced by those panels. Whereas with the generation-based model, we've seen that with the Salt River Project in Arizona. They sell blocks, what they call a block, which is about 2,500 kilowatt hours per year. So in that case, customers are just signing up for those kilowatt hours from the solar project, and the utility guarantees them a price for those kilowatt hours that they're buying. So once you've figured out, you know, how to structure the program in terms of a capacity-based or generation-based model, SEPA, which is the Solar Energy Power Association, they've developed this just basic schematic for how to figure out how much to charge your participants. So the basic concept is that You want to add up your marketing and administration costs, as well as the cost of the solar supply, as well as any operation and maintenance costs. Some utilities may have an integration cost, which is any work that may be done needed to be done to balance that solar generation or anything like that. So you want to add up all those costs, divide that by 20 years or whatever the expected life of the project is. So you'll get a cost either in terms of the cost per kilowatt or the cost per kilowatt hour. And one thing to think about in terms of pricing this program is whether you want to include an additional incentive. So some utilities will offer an incentive similar to what they give their net metering customers. So it may be an upfront rebate of, $500 or something like that, or it may be a performance-based incentive of a certain cents per kilowatt hour that they're giving that would be similar to what they give their net metering customers. So if this all seems a little confusing or you need more information or assistance, NREL does have some tools available. The system advisor model is a tried and true model that's used widely. It basically looks at your local area and makes predictions about the cost of energy coming from solar PV. And you can run a variety of scenarios and look at different expected outputs for a potential system. That's free to download at the website that you'll see there. The second tool we are developing is a community solar tool. We may get a better acronym. Still not sure yet, but we're developing this tool because we've seen a lot of community interest in community solar programs lately, and a lot of folks are interested in some sort of spreadsheet tool to help them figure out how to price their product. Can be sort of a complicated calculation and depends on a variety of different variables. And this spreadsheet tool allows you to evaluate different options for how to price the tool. So that's something that is in development, and we're happy to work with you if you would like us to run different scenarios or things like that, but it's not yet publicly available. So in terms of risks and regulatory considerations, there are, a number of programs already out there operating. I want to just present these as things to consider, not that they're roadblocks or would make the project not go forward, but they're just things you should think about as you go through this process. And I've broken these down into local, state, and federal considerations. One of the first, local things to think about is how much expected demand do you have? So do you have a sense of how many customers might sign up if you opened up this project? And a lot of, that can be done through market research or working with your stakeholders to get a better sense of who might actually sign up and what level of support there is in the community. The second thing to look at is any permitting and zoning requirements. In some cases, if you were an investor-owned utility operating in a city that you weren't familiar with, this would be more of a problem. But just making sure that any zoning and permitting stuff is taken care of. And then lastly, this may be specific to you all, I'm not sure, but making sure you're in compliance with any local charter and ordinances that may be related to buying or selling property or things like that. At the state level, you want to make sure that if you need it, you have enabling legislation for PPAs, power purchase agreements, and virtual net metering, if that's applicable to you all. On the federal side, we talked a little bit about the investment tax credit. That's the 30% tax credit for solar investments. The other thing I wanted to highlight was securities compliance. So this is a little bit of a tricky issue, but it actually programs have found a way to work through it. And the key point here is that you want to avoid looking like you're selling a security. If you're selling a security, you have to go through the Securities and Exchange Commission, as well as any state Securities and Exchange Commission at that level, which provides, you know, a lot more scrutiny and take a lot of time and things like that. Generally, you know, community solar programs are operating in ways that don't fall into that bucket. But there are a few things to consider when you're marketing your program to make sure that you don't fall in that bucket that would be considered a security. So some of the things that SEPA and others recommend is that basically that the contract and the pricing and the billing arrangements, it all resembles a customary consumer purchase of non-solar electricity. So you're selling something that's similar to non-solar electricity. And you also want to make sure that the marketing materials don't emphasize that the amount of solar power sold depends on the participation of other customers. So it's a, sort of a nitty-gritty issue, but those issues are important to consider. And I would just highlight, I'm not a tax or legal specialist, so we always caution that, you know, please, you know, do your due diligence on that end, but just know that these issues have been worked out and there are ways to do it that, that won't qualify you as a security. So when we look at what's the process moving forward for these types of programs, first step is usually getting some direction from the board or city council or whoever, you know, in other utilities it's a different structure, but that seems to be the structure for you all. Then you want to really look at, you know, what ownership model makes sense for you all. Do a feasibility analysis for that model as well as the actual sites that you may be able to put solar on. You also want to make sure you're doing your community outreach, engaging your key stakeholders. That's something that potentially can be done throughout this process. And then finally, you know, once you sort of figured out this model and gotten approval and all that sort of stuff, you'll actually develop the project, construct it, and have operation and maintenance. So that's sort of the gist of community solar. I hope that was useful. And I want to take some time to answer your questions about things that were in the slides or other questions that you may have that were brought to mind during the presentation.
Any questions? Could you go back to the slide that showed the financial kind of models? Oh, you just went past it, I think. Forward from there, and again, that one. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the six components, administration, marketing, supply, operation, maintenance, and integration, gives you the total cost. Let's say it's going to be a utility-owned facility that the utility would have to invest. Would there typically then be a buy-in cost for each customer to cover some of those components, and the rest would be paid for in the per kilowatt or per kilowatt hour billing?
Typically what we see is either it's an upfront cost or it's a monthly cost. You could potentially have a hybrid approach. Most programs that we've seen, though, have either said, you know, you pay $600 up front and then you just get the bill credits going forward, or you pay a little bit per month and also get the bill credits in relation to how much you're paying.
What do the bill credits mean?
The bill credit would be similar to if you have net metering on your home. You'll get a bill credit for any generation that was produced. So in this case, you know, if you have a kilowatt subscription, you will get credit for the generation that that kilowatt is providing to the system. Does that make sense?
I see. And your personal, as a customer, your personal consumption is then just kind of balanced
against
that.
Subtracted out. Yeah, exactly.
Got it. I see.
Yep. Yep, so it's a way to allow folks who can't have solar on their home and do net metering to have a similar arrangement with a larger facility that's not on their property.
And then is there a calculation done to see how long it takes to get to a break-even point, either for a customer or for the utility? And how do those calculations turn out?
So, yes, there is commonly a calculation done to determine that, both for the utility and for the customer who's purchasing. That calculation obviously will vary depending on a number of things, including the cost of the solar system and all these components listed here. So that's something that our modeling work can help to some degree with. I actually was just sharing with staff a proposal that I got for my home for a community solar garden, and they basically presented that business case of your payback is this many number of years and this is the percent payback annually and things like that. So that's a common way to market the program to folks.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And presumably that payback period, if we're kind of estimating that 20 years is a lifetime for one of these systems, is somewhat less than 20 years.
That's really the way to make it work financially for the customer. You know, that's up to you guys in terms of what you think the appropriate way to price the product is and what your local market looks like and things like that. But the programs we've seen around the country have found a way to make that work. Yep.
So in terms of cost, you could estimate initially what those costs would be for the next 20 years up front, and then either charge each person an upfront cost for that, and then they get that amount of solar for 20 years at a steady that price. It's a known price.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's another key benefit that some programs highlight, is that, you know, the price is fixed over 20 years, whereas the price of your regular power probably is going up realistically. So especially when programs are marketing to business customers, that's an interest for them more than a residential customer, is knowing the price of their electricity for 20 years. So, sure.
And then another model is just taking that upfront cost and spreading it out in payments to the from the customer with, is it an interest rate then?
It would depend on how you wanted to structure it, but you could charge interest for that over time. It could be done in a variety of ways. If you wanted to offer a no interest plan, that's, you know, that would be something that you probably would just want to financially model and determine whether that makes sense.
And can you tell me how this compares on the average with people who are just doing individual solar on their homes and taking advantage of the ITC credit?
Mm-hmm. So typically it's cost competitive or cheaper than for the customer than if they had put it on their home. Another advantage is that you broaden the pool of folks who are even able to take advantage of solar. So that's another consideration. But the pricing I've seen for these programs is lower than what we've seen for residential, you know, home installation.
And then after 20 years, then they're if it's still working and operating, yeah, is it free or are they out of the program? And
yeah, so
customers can use it, or how does that work?
So it could work in a variety of ways. You could either say to the customer, your time is up and see you later. You could say, in that case, maybe we're just going to use this for system power. We're going to just incorporate it into our general mix. You could offer the customer an option to sort of continue or buy into a second phase or something like that. You could open it up to new customers if, you know, maybe they couldn't get in on the first round. So there are a variety of ways you could deal with that. And 20 years is not necessarily the the only number. So that'll depend on, you know, what is your expected life of the system, which, you know, maybe it's 25 years. I've even seen some companies guaranteeing 50 years if they're handling the operations and maintenance themselves. So that number is also dependent upon the system.
Yeah, I take it that your comment about securities really had to do with the securities bucket, that is, the warning that you not base this on other people's participation. Is that that's the take-home message from that securities idea, outside of the fact that it would involve lots more time and effort and so on and so forth?
Yeah, exactly. So just to be careful about how the product is marketed to consumers and the language that you use in that marketing. And it's, I mean, you could potentially go through Securities and Exchange Commission process, but
And that would kind of trigger that, depending on how you frame the argument in terms of...
Exactly, yeah. So you don't want to trigger that and have that extra added compliance and regulatory work.
And one other question. We're having this discussion currently within the context of our own community, because we are kind of unique that we have our own municipal utility, the community solar versus the net metering idea. And frankly, there is the option of having a hybrid of doing both of those kinds of things, but I suspect that that would bring the argument, in terms of net metering at least, to how do we deal with leasing or renting the transmission lines that would be necessary for assessing some sort of charge for people to be able to generate their own electricity. So there is that discussion that's ongoing right now with us in terms of the advantages for the community solar, because we have that network involved, and the question as to how we can assess that other fee to have some sort of hybrid model. I guess my question is, how many of these models, most of these models, I take it, I'm assuming, but I may be wrong, are hybrid models that have some of the net metering components and some of the community solar components, or are these really dead? Are communities going to a community solar model, or a net metering model? Is most of the trend a hybrid?
Let me just clarify what you mean by hybrid. I guess typically what we see is that there's net metering in the community, which allows residential or commercial customers to put solar on site. Then there's also community solar, which is separate but additional to that. Mm-hmm. Is that what you mean by hybrid?
That's what I mean by hybrid, yes.
Yeah, so that's what we see primarily. In fact, I'm not aware of communities that have built community solar but then gotten rid of net metering. I think most communities that are doing community solar see interest in solar in their community, and they want to provide an additional option for their ratepayers to participate. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. That's kind of what I had in mind. I was just kind of curious as to what the national trends are in terms of adopting one or the other of these approaches, and I would suspect that probably a hybrid is appropriate, and you've said that. So.
Yeah. We have net metering has been around for a lot longer, right? So we have net metering, I think, in 42 states, something like that. You know, we have about 40 community solar programs located, you know, not in 40 different states, so they're sort of clustered. But the trend is to offer both of those programs.
I have a really dumb question. What difference between a kilowatt and a kilowatt hour?
That's not a dumb question, and it actually is kind of an obscure thing, right? We don't really think in kilowatts or kilowatt hours unless you're a utility person or an energy analyst.
I have a net metering agreement, solar panels, and I don't understand my bill, and I don't understand how it works. And
yeah, that's completely understandable because it is confusing. So if you have a system on your home, it's probably a couple kilowatts,
1.2,
I guess. Yeah. So 1.2 kilowatts. That's sort of a measure of the capacity of
maximum
that.
Maximum capacity to generate at any given time?
Exactly. So you're going to have your kilowatts. So say you, let's just say you have 1 kilowatt. Your kilowatt hour will be the actual electricity output over an hour. So it's a way of distinguishing the capacity of the system versus what is actually being generated.
I got you.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. So we use kilowatt hours because it's of some period of time or whatever.
Exactly. So your bill will typically be, you know, in cents per kilowatt hour, you know, 10 cents per kilowatt hour, depending on how many kilowatt hours you use. Then you calculate the total dollars that you end up paying.
All right. I did understand. I just want to make sure.
Good.
I guess where you run into your security problems is people will move or die or whatever, and how would they transfer their interest if these are set up so that they're not a security?
Mm-hmm. The way I've seen programs do that to date has been to transfer it back to the utility, and then the utility could offer that to another customer that's on a waiting list or something like that.
Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, I guess another benefit we didn't talk about, but with community solar, if you're moving within the utility service territory, programs just allow you to keep your subscription, you know, rather than if you had it on your home and you move, then you have to.
Right, because it's not tied to an address.
Right.
And I suppose if you're moving out of the service area, your payments could follow you because you have an interest in solar generation, and it could just serve some other customer or not?
Typically, if you're moving out of the service territory, folks will have to give up their subscription because, you know, if you guys implemented a community solar program, you would have an agreement, you know, based on the folks who live here, and it's run by, you know, overseen by the city council and things like that. And you know, if I live here and I'm a member and then I move to St. Louis, you would have to have a relationship with that other utility in order to keep getting the bill credits.
Okay.
And that's, I don't know if that's impossible, but it would be rather challenging, I would think.
The fact that we're asking these minutia type questions suggests that we're interested in the overall concept as being very innovative and useful.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think there's definitely a large movement towards community solar, and, you know, there are a lot of different ways to do it. So I guess, you know, one of the main takeaways is just this is, you know, happening, and it's possible to do, and think about different ways you could do it and what might work best for you all.
And you may have said this in the beginning. Does the utility initiate this, or does a private company initiate this, or does that depend on which of the three models we're talking about?
Typically, in each of the models, it will be the utility that is initiating the process, given support from their governing body. So the utility, even if they were working with a third party, would still initiate that process. You know, they might issue a request for proposals from third parties or something like
that.
Who might
actually do the installations and
exactly.
So forth.
Yeah, so it would be up to the utility to get that set up.
Is there any technical reason why you would necessarily need multiple small solar gardens distributed around the community, or does it work just as well to have one site that plugs into the grid?
So there could be considerations based on the condition of your local grid. And I won't claim to be an expert on your local grid, but for example, if you had an area where you sort of had a pocket that could use some reinforcement, maybe it makes sense to locate a project there. Maybe there are multiple pockets like that. In that case, it might make sense to have multiple locations. The downside to that is you'll be developing multiple projects instead of just siting at one place, which could simplify things to some degree in terms of doing the installation and even maintenance and things like that. That's really context specific, and I don't have a good answer for here.
When we're talking about maintenance, how long does a solar panel live? Do they live forever?
That's a good question. I guess we don't know if they live forever, but I think actually at NREL we have a testing lab, and you know there are solar panels that are 30, 35 years old. They're still generating electricity. Mm-hmm. Typically what we see is degradation over time on an annual basis, but mm-hmm. Even after 20 or 25 years, it's highly likely that it will still be generating something. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I know it's I can't expect you to put numbers on it, but maintenance is pretty minimal, really, isn't it, once it's built? I mean, there's no moving parts. Mm-hmm. As long as you build it right, it's pretty much, what do? You clean it off?
Yeah, for solar PV, maintenance is not a big component. I don't have numbers off the top of my head, but our models do throw in some stock numbers that are pretty well accepted. It's mostly, cleaning, making sure, if you're in a field of grass, making sure the right. grass doesn't, grow over the solar panels. But making sure, you don't have shading issues. So,
but it's the kind of thing you can't put under a carport, otherwise you'd have shade, right? I mean, it's out in the weather all the time, so there is that kind of, and there must be depreciation and so on, and there is a reduction in the capacity over time. I mean, mm-hmm. just like depreciation, I would think. But.
Yeah. So the panels will degrade over time.
But less so than something with mechanical parts. I mean, certainly. I have no question.
Yeah, the degradation, I think, is estimated at about 0.5% per year. It's sort of an industry figure, and that will depend on the type of panels that you install, and manufacturers can usually provide more information about, what the...
But that's true whether you have community solar or stuff on your roof. It's the same kind of situation.
Yeah, same just basic, fundamentals of solar panels.
Mm-hmm. I don't know, do you have any comments for areas where we have unstable weather? You had your example for one of your pricing models of Arizona where they sell 95%. I don't know that we would, if we were using that, we'd have to pick a much lower target simply because of the variability of the weather here. I don't know if you have any comments about that. It must make our water and light department's job very hard to predict a few days in advance how much power they need to generate. And I don't know if solar actually helps that problem or if it's an additional complication with community solar. And I don't know, that's a question for either of you or both of you as you see fit.
Well, from a weather perspective, we've seen some of the production off our existing facilities to very much match our load. So we really like the load projections that photovoltaics hold for the shape of our system. Uh-huh. So our loads go up in the summertime. Likewise, PV cells generally generate more in the summertime, so that we feel like it's a very good match. We are in the MISO market, so it really is generating at times that some of the market prices are fairly higher for us to be out there with. So we like the look of it.
So it could actually be to our advantage to invest in solar. I'm thinking of the days where the weather forecast is 100% chance of rain, and then at noon the sun comes out and it gets blazing hot. And I would think that
there is a lot of our
solar
load
would come online faster than you could turn on a gas generator.
Yeah, there is a lot of our load that is tied to the sun being out and heating of the structures out there. But two weather things in Missouri that I know some of our photovoltaic folks right now worry about is hail. that has been something that they are a little concerned about, some of those weather things that happen here like that. And the other thing is, because of the humidity, there is a lot of the times that we will still be setting peaks on a nice humid summer night after the sun goes down. So there's kind of they're not perfectly aligned from a curve perspective, but there is a lot of overlap. Uh-huh.
What do we need to do to move forward?
Well, Jenny, if you're done, I certainly, unless you guys give us a reason not to proceed, our intent is to go through the process. Jenny had a bunch of steps in here that we need to wade through, and there's a lot of decisions that we need to put some models to. We're going to probably have some help to kind of analyze what our systems are, what the cost we see, and how to go forward. A couple of items of that I want to make sure that you understand are important considerations for us going forward is the city charter. There is some wording, there is some language in our charter that restricts the way water and light assets can be sold from the charter perspective, and I think the intent of what the original charter language was to obviously go through a formal public election process to sell the utility. So there's a language in there that kind of governs what you can do with water and light assets from the charter perspective. Now, in this case, you know, I don't think this really meets the intent of what the charter was talking about. But nonetheless, we're going to have to address how the charter treats water and light assets. And I think that's Section 101 of the city charter that actually says restriction of sale of water and light property. So that's one of the things we're going to have to wade through is make sure we understand how that works.
And was that intent to keep Water and Light Department from wheeling and dealing in property?
I think it was in the intent of the charter was to keep the city council from deciding to sell the utility.
Ah.
They wanted the public to vote on that. Now, that's just my interpretation of what the charter says in that place. The other thing that Jenny alluded to was the Securities and Exchange Commission filings. This is something that would be a real liability for our finance department for us to incur reporting requirements in SEC type filings. And there's really been a lot of activity in this arena lately. There's an act called the Dodd-Frank Act that had a lot to do with the Securities and Exchange rules that have changed, and for lack of a better word, the electric utility industry was kind of a little bit of collateral damage on this laws, and so we're still working through some of the rules and some of the exemptions that go through with that. So that is really an area that we've been dealing with from a liability standpoint right now, and that is somewhere that we want to make sure that we stay out of. And Jenny made a very good point, is we don't want this process to be like an investment property. We don't want it to be where you go and you buy something, you invest, and you can – and there's a market for it. We want to stay out of the Securities and Exchange Commission filings on these things. So that's going to be an important piece that we need to understand how we play into that. And like she said, it's going to take legal help for us to make sure when we make these recommendations that we know how this is going to play out. Our finance department's going to have a big hand in this because this is really putting a lot of liability on their shoulders if we do it wrong to be able to make these filings. The other things that I would just want to bring up for your consideration is we have a lot of rental folks in this community, and so we want to make sure that we take that into account. I don't have a solution for you. There's a lot of questions I'm bringing up here that I don't have answers for you right now. But there is a lot of rental folks in the community, and if we could structure this in such a way that it could be an asset, a tool, it would be something that could be work in that community, I think that's one of the focuses that we would like to kind of keep in front of us going forward to be able to understand that market's out there. So certainly some of the advantages that we see that, you know, because there's a lot of rentals that this is an asset to the property, and this particular program isn't really a property asset. It's a person type thing. It's assigned to the person. So we see some places that this could work for the rental community. As usual, the devil's in the details on these programs on how they go forward and how they're structured. So there's a lot of steps that we're going to have to go through in this process, but our plan is to proceed forward to working with taking all these things to account. We're probably going to have some consultant help similar to what the National Renewable Energy Labs has started for us, and we'll start bringing back some recommendations through our board to this council on here's how we think this program could be put together and work. But we really do feel like this holds some good potential for the utility and the customers in this.
Yeah.
One thing that's important is she went through the two models, the generation model and the capacity model. Really, the capacity model is more like a net metering type of an arrangement, and that's the model I kind of like because it looks like a net metering arrangement. You talked about how it shows up on the bill. In this case, it's called virtual net metering, which means that off this, it goes into your bill as if it was behind your meter. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of interesting things that I think really play good with this is if we can have this program work like a net metering customer is, I think the customers would understand the choice that they're given here on whether they make an investment at their own site or they make an investment off-site and it shows up on their bill the same. We do have the Solar One project right now, and that is run more like the generation model, whereas the energy is sold in blocks, and we have programs right now that operate similar to that. So these are some of the things we're really going to have to wade through the details and how they're going to roll out.
Ted, is the Solar One project, is that the facility on Worley that generates that energy?
Most of the projects are third-party projects. In other words, we go out for bids, and there's a private industry that actually buys.
Oh, from outside the community?
Yes, and, well, inside our system.
Okay.
So they actually buy a site, and they're mounted on their own private property, and then we buy the energy from them and sell it to our customers in kilowatt-hour energy blocks. I think we do it at 100, mm-hmm. at 100 kilowatt-hour energy blocks. So the Solar One follows the generation model, and it goes under our third-party structure here. So we kind of know how that works, but that's not really how net metering works from a private industry. It's kind of on the other side.
So on Solar One, there are a number of physical solar collector arrays that are feeding into the system.
Yes, mostly on about, I think, 3 or 4 commercial sites in town.
And I think this may be more a question for Jenny. In the community solar projects, the 40 or so, typically what percentage of the community's energy is provided from the community solar project?
The percent provided by the community solar project can vary to a great degree. The list I left with staff has, you know, the existing community solar programs and their capacity. The capacities vary by quite a bit. So we have seen some community solar programs that are, you know, 10 kilowatts. We've seen others that are on the megawatt, multi-megawatt scale. So, of course, then the percentage would depend on how big that utility system is.
And I guess our trick would be to get one or two of these projects going under this umbrella, and then it would be sort of up to the public to decide how much they want to invest. Would there be capacity constraints on our end once we open the doors for this?
Yeah, that's true. The only things that we have to balance, and we would probably want to engage in some sort of a market assessment to have at least some predisposition on how much participation we would expect, because as you can imagine, when you have a developer comes to town, he's not going to want to come every month to build a little bit here and there. He's going to want to show up with a predefined scope, and he's going to build whatever you think you're going to need for some period of time, and then he's going to go somewhere else and build. So it would be nice to be able to evolve the program. It's just that's the most expensive way to do it too. So you got to play that out.
I see.
And then this would fit in our renewable energy. I mean, it would count towards
yes.
our renewable energy.
Yes.
Which the public has expressed an interest in increasing.
Yes.
The federal investment tax credit, have I heard that might be going away at a certain point?
The federal investment tax credit is scheduled to expire in 2016. And actually, it falls back into a 10% bucket instead of 30%. You may be familiar with the production tax credit, which is utilized by wind generation. That has not seen as long of a extended life. It expires at the end of this year with certain caveats. Yeah.
From a political point of view, there's not a movement to extend those?
The investment tax credit for solar, you know, because it's still a little bit early on, there hasn't, at least I'm not aware of a big push to extend that right now. The production tax credit has usually been extended on 1 to 2 year increments, and that's usually a very large political battle. We did see it actually expire at certain points, so that's more of a political conundrum or fight. Yeah, I don't know what the appropriate word is, but the ITC is in place until 2016.
So a follow-up question is, everything went really well on the city's end. How soon could we do this to potentially, if we wanted to use that model, take advantage of the federal tax credits?
Well, obviously, we can't take advantage of this
right.
federal tax
I know.
Credit, so
it
we would have to enter
a
third partnership
party.
With somebody.
Right.
Yeah. We actually have an RFP out that we've actually put the responses, and we've engaged in conversation with them already on the possibility of the partnership to be able to put a program like this together. So we actually have some counterparties that have responded that we could participate with on this project. There's some of the steps in this process to get from the start to the end that we just need to put some plans together before we can really answer the question, how fast could we do this? We have a lot of the pieces in place, as you can see. We've been actively pursuing it, so we have suppliers that we're talking with. We have some program designers that we're taking a look at. But as far as actually getting to the point where we're ready to pull the trigger and ask for financing to go forward and tell you how much it's going to cost and how it's going to be paid for and what the revenue stream is, we're just not quite there yet.
Well, we'll anxiously await your further comments.
Yeah. And we obviously want to keep an eye on that 2016 date, because a lot harder after that if that goes away.
So the point of this is to bring us up to speed on some of the things that are in the works, and you are continuing to pursue this kind of thing, and will bring it to us as soon as you have that kind of information.
And certainly one of the things I want is if there's any problems you see or any thing that you want to tell us that we shouldn't be headed this direction or what direction you wouldn't want to see us go, this is where we're headed. This is what we're looking at. This is where we're going. So please give us any of your comments if there's anything in this direction.
Well,
that you're
I think the only comment that I would make in that regard is that I tend to favor this hybrid approach to having both of these opportunities available. I think there is great benefit from the community solar point of view. It makes a great deal of sense. There is also a great deal of benefit from the net metering point of view, and I think that that's a blend of those kinds of things is probably a reasonable direction to head.
Okay. Well, let me say thank you, Jenny, for coming all the way from Colorado. I think as a point of interest, we weren't sure you were going to make it for about 10 days there. So,
your travel budget
reappeared, so we're glad to have you. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me. And please let me do know if you have other questions going forward.
Okay, thank you. We'll take a brief recess to start promptly at 7:00.